53, but then a rainy night on Wednesday night, low 45. Here are the numbers. Wind east at 12, 45 degrees for both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're about to have a conversation about one of the most important social agencies in Kenosha, namely KFASI, Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services. They do so much good work for so many people in the community. And we're going to be talking about that and about a big event which is coming up tomorrow out at the Parkway Chateau adjacent to the famous Bratstop. And this is one of the, if not the biggest fundraiser for KFASI, called Bowls and Bakers. And in this week where the weather has turned a little bit chilly, what sounds could be possibly better than a wonderful bowl of soup? And this big fundraiser has been going on for over 20 years. And so we want to make sure that we take the opportunity to remind people about this opportunity to support KFASI and all of the good work that they do. In our studios today, first of all, Ron Tatum, who is Executive Director of KFASI, and also with us, Judy Abate, who is Director of Human Resources there. And I have a feeling both of them have been incredibly busy over the last few weeks and days and hours preparing for this huge event, which is, again, coming up tomorrow from 11 to 1:30 out at Parkway Chateau. Ron Tatum, Judy Abate, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks for having us. We're excited to be here. Always good to see you.
Good to have you here as well. We'll start talking about soup and this big event in just a little bit, but I think it would be great for anybody who is listening who might not be directly acquainted with KFASI to have a good understanding of what you are about and the kind of things that you offer to the community. So let's begin there.
Absolutely, Dave. Thanks again for having us. We're excited to be here. Hello to all our friends and out there. KFASI stands for acronym Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services Incorporated. Our mission is to promote healthy aging, strong families, and a connected community. Dave, I like to share with people that we touch every area of the household from beginning of life all the way to aging of life. Beginning of life through our family services programs and the impact they have on families that address family preservation, anger management, counseling, and a few other things associated with families' needs. We also have our aging program, which is our largest programs. Our largest one that is well known in this community is the Meals on Wheels program. We are the largest Meals on Wheels in southeastern Wisconsin. We have the largest volunteer base in all of southeastern Wisconsin. So shout out to my volunteers. We couldn't do it without you guys, those of you who are listening this morning. And we have a number of nutrition programs from senior dining programs where we provide congregate setting 5 days a week at five different locations throughout the city and county. And so we're very excited to, you know, share our programs and what we do at KFASI. We have over 16 programs. They're powerful and impactful programs. And again, most people know us by our Meals on Wheels program, and we've sort of changed that narrative. Our Meals on Wheels program is our largest program, but we've done a great job in the community educating people on our other programs. You know, things like music and memory that help people who are struggling with dementia and Alzheimer's, and companionship programs. One of the things we found out during COVID that many people were left alone. And so we have companionship programs where our volunteers range from college students all the way to the aging population. And sometimes what I really love about my work is that we are sometimes the first and only contact with some of these individuals throughout the day. So friendships, relationships are built that last a lifetime. And so I can go on and on. I could take up your whole segment talking about that, Dave, and what we do at Kafasi. But that's just a little glimpse of what we do. And we just love what we do. I'm passionate about it, as you can tell.
Yeah, well, with very, very good reason. Judy Abate, your director of human resources at Kafasi, tell us a little bit more about the role that you play and what this means to you.
Sure. Thanks again for having us this morning. I think I've been with the agency about 2 years, and I came after my interview with Ron. I came to Kafasi because I was passionate about what I was doing. I left corporate America, and I came here deliberately because I wanted to have an impact on the people in our community. And boy, did I land at the right spot! so every day, Ron always says, "Know your why before you walk through our front door," and I think that's something that we really try to instill in our employees. That's a big part of my job, finding the right people. I sometimes call them the golden unicorn when I find the right person that I know is going to have the passion and the dedication to do the work that is so important. And so Ron has kind of adopted that, you know, find me a golden unicorn for our open positions. And so we really need to make sure that we staff our agency with the people that have the heart to serve and the willingness to come to work every day knowing their why.
I like that so much. So how many staff are we talking about at Kafasi?
Today we have 43. We have several open positions, but right now, today we have 43 wonderful staff members.
Very good. I suspect that when it comes to a big event like tomorrow's Bowls and Bakers, that all hands are on deck. I mean, I suspect it, this is something in which you have to have a lot of paddles in the water, right?
Indeed we do. Organized chaos a little bit sometimes, but because we have done this for many years, there's some blueprints for us to follow. We've made some changes to adapt and make our event even better every year. But we have tons of community volunteers that are donating items for our gift baskets, our raffle baskets. We've had several work sessions where people are putting together centerpieces and putting those baskets together. So, yeah, it is definitely all hands on deck, no doubt about that.
Yeah, this is one of the few times where I tell the employees that they are voluntold.
I like that. So tell us a little bit about, for both of you, you've just been with Kafasi just over a couple of years, but we're talking about an event that has quite a long history. Do you know anything about that history?
Absolutely. 21 years this event has been taking place, and it's been, you know, what's so amazing about it, Dave, is community-driven. We could not do this for 21 years without the buy-in of the community, our partners, our friendships, and the relationships that we have. And, you know, when you talk about an event like Bowls and Bakers, there's a lot of work, absolutely, that goes behind the scenes of what we have to do internally, but to get, you know, vendors, soup vendors and chefs to come out and, you know, take time away from their restaurant, right, for setup. If you're counting setup and everything else, it's about 4 hours that they lose from their day-to-day in their own restaurants, and they provide that time to us free of charge with some of the best soups in the county.
Wow. So explain to somebody who has never visited this program, this event, what sort of greets them when they walk into the Parkway Chateau?
Yeah, I think I can take that one. Last year was my first year, so I knew a little bit about Bowls and Bakers, but I had to experience it hands on deck. And so that event from setup to cleanup is really is amazing. So when a someone's going to come in and enjoy Bowls and Bakers, they're going to be greeted at the front door. They're going to receive a commemorative soup cup. We have a really awesome cup this year that we had some sponsors from Dooley and Associates and Pillar Health that helped us make that become a reality for all of our participants.
Shout out to Jennifer Dooley and Greg Powell, by the way. We appreciate you.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. Then tables are set, and they are free once they find their favorite table. They're free to go and visit the soup vendors and sample as many soups as they want. They're going to have a voting ballot at their place after they've sampled all the soups they care to enjoy. They're going to vote for their favorite one. While they're doing that, there's also a large area of raffle baskets. Like I said, we have over 41 baskets this year so far. They visit those baskets and put tickets in there, hoping to win and go home with a basket along with their commemorative cup. And we also have an amazing bakery section where lots of donated bakery items have come. Some people bake. They have done this traditionally, as I understand, for years. They bake their favorite pie or their favorite cake and donate. We have lots of community sponsors that donate their baked goods. So you really get a complete meal. You go home full of soup and sweets. So
absolutely.
Everyone loves it.
And we can't forget the raffle ticket from Jim Smiegel, one of our vendors of Hoffman House, has been donating Packer Bears tickets for the last 7 years, I'm told.
Wow.
So,
you were saying before we went on the air that some of these vendors have actually been part of Bowls and Bakers from the very start.
Absolutely.
For all 21 years, which is amazing.
All 21 years, again, it speaks to the commitment and the dedication of our community. And, you know, again, our vendors do this. They take time for their restaurant, and they donate this time to us. And to be doing it for that many years speaks to the importance of how they feel about our programs and the impact that we're having on the community. We couldn't do it without them.
Hmm. So for each of them, do they just come, each of the vendors who are going to be providing soup, do they just come with whatever soup they choose, or do you try to exert a little bit of coordination so we don't end up with nine kinds of chili or nine kinds of vegetable or whatever? I mean,
well the thing about these soup vendors over the years, they built a relationship with one another, so it's become a little bit of competition.
A friendly competition,
if you will. And so they pretty much know what each other is doing, and so they bring their best soups. We haven't had the same soup mirror one another in quite some time, I'm told. And so just you know, a little friendly competition, I think a little friendly rager amongst the group. This year we will be, you know, acknowledging the best soup, who's ever voted for the best soup. We have a huge acknowledgement and trophy for them.
You were saying before we went on the air that there is someone who has been a part of this event for quite some time, who sadly will not be able to be among the mix this year, and I know you want to take a moment to pay tribute to them.
Yeah, thanks for that. I want to extend our condolences to Chad Cantwell of Wilmot Stay Stop, who's been a huge supporter of our program for many years, even before me, Dave, and unexpectedly passed away last week, Thursday. We got the news, and they had to actually step out from being part of the event, which is completely understandable. We do want to remember him and do an acknowledgement of him at this event. We will still have a table set up dedicated just for him there, and we will have a pause too in memory. And so if his family is listening, we want to thank you for loaning him to us throughout these years. His volunteer work speaks volumes to the type of man that he was, and we'll miss him.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, we are talking today in the first part of today's morning show with Ron Tatum, Executive Director of CAFASI, the Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services, and Judy Abate joins us as well, Director of Human Resources. And we are talking today on the eve of one of their biggest events of the year, Bowls and Bakers, which is taking place out at the Parkway Chateau from 11 o'clock until 1:30. And your admission price gives you the opportunity to sample some absolutely spectacular soups, some delicious bakery, to participate in the big raffle and help to support the great work of CAFASI that goes on all year long. One of the things that is a claim to fame for CAFASI is that you get to boast of the largest volunteer base in Kenosha.
Yes.
So tell us just how many volunteers are we talking about, and in what sort of wide-ranging roles do they play a part in what CAFASI does?
Oh, my God. We have some of the best volunteers, Dave, in the county. I would say in the state of Wisconsin. And we have, at last count, over 428 total volunteers. Encompasses all of our programs, and you know, it speaks to the commitment and the heart to serve and the passion that they have to give back. I've been around this program, as shared with you, for 2.5 years. I've traveled to conferences, and we are one of the few agencies that has volunteers that are not paid for what they do. So just think about that for a moment. We have volunteers who are doing this work daily out of the kindness of their heart. Why would I want to be anywhere else but Kafasi, working alongside people who know that it's not about them at the end of the day? It's about the impact and lives that they have an opportunity to share, and the platforms that they have to build these relationships and these reports. We're more than just a mill. We're more than just an agency. We build relationships with these individuals, as shared with you before, and sometimes this is their only contact with our volunteers throughout the day. And it is statistically identified that aging population and individuals who don't have constant contact or conversations or that type of communication lose years to their life.
Mm.
Our volunteers are adding years to people's lives. Just think about that for a moment. And so I love my volunteers. I get emotional talking about them because of their commitment and the impact that they've had on lives and the extension of life that they're providing to these individuals that may not be known by many.
And Judy Abate, I should think that when you are looking for people to hire to be staff at Kafasi, that the fact that many of them are going to be working with volunteers, that's probably one of the things I should think you look for in terms of the qualities that you need for effective staff.
Absolutely. When we do our pre-screening, those are exactly some of our questions. That would include, you know, what do you know about a nonprofit? Because it's very different working in a nonprofit versus working in corporate America. You know, what is your heart to serve? And if, you know, someone says, I want to join your agency because I want to climb the ladder, or, you know, what's the next position? They're probably not the right person for us because, A, we don't have a lot of climbing.
It's not much of a ladder. Huh?
Right. There's not much of a ladder. And we really are looking for people with that heart to serve and also obviously bringing their skill set, but they have to really have that complement of both of those things. They have to have the skills to do their job and a heart to serve. So that's definitely what we look for.
You know, I'm finding myself thinking back to what you said early on in this interview about how you came to Kafasi from corporate America, obviously in search of, in maybe in need of a different environment in which to work. Can you just talk a little bit more about that, or describe just what that shift is about?
Sure. You know, I think as I really got to a point where I was reflecting, I loved my work. I've been in HR for a long time. I've had several different careers, but been in HR for a long time. And I came to work every day in my previous job. I loved the people I worked with, but I realized all I was really doing was making millionaires more money. I wasn't really having an impact. And I've always been a person that loved to volunteer. You know, as I grew up with my kids, we always were in scouts and church things. And I just realized that my side volunteer work wasn't filling my bucket, so to speak. And I started looking for different opportunities. And I looked for a couple years before I really found the right fit. And when I had that first interview with Ron, I was just hoping and praying that it was going to be a match, because as I left that office that day after that interview, I knew I had found my, you know, my next career home, if you will.
And it sounds like Ron Tatum agreed with you.
I had a great selling point.
Yeah, very good. Well, it's great to hear about all of the good work that is going on. You know, Ron Tatum, I appreciate what you said right off the bat, that that Kafasi is about a whole lot more than Meals on Wheels. But we should probably take a minute or two and talk about Meals on Wheels nevertheless, because it is so important. And I suppose one of the main purposes of it is that something like Meals on Wheels is probably a reason why some people can remain in their own home.
Absolutely.
I mean, if they did not have that, that would probably change the equation. Tell us more about the difference that it makes.
I mean, Dave, we have people who are making difficult choices every day to either pay for medication and or food. Think about that for a moment. Mm. And so we are in a position where we check the food box, not only the food box. We're more than just a meal. We create that relationship and that partnership and that visibility and contact with these individuals on a daily basis. And this program is so huge in our community, and it's only getting larger. The aging population is the fastest and largest growing demographic in the nation right now. in 3 to 4 years, think about that for a moment, it will eclipse those of 18 years old and younger. So the need and the demand is only going to increase. When you look at things like the economy and inflation, seniors are impacted too.
Yeah, of course they are. Absolutely.
And we can't forget about them. And our demand is only going to increase, and the resources that are going to need are only going to increase, which is why we need the support of the community, our government, our dignitaries, talk to Congress about, funding to this initiative. I was just at a Meals on Wheels conference in Baltimore, and we talked about this very thing, about hashtag Save the Lunch campaign was the motto, which is where we don't want to put individuals on a wait list because we don't have enough resources, meaning fundings, to support the increase in demand with a population that is growing so fastly and
right.
quickly.
So how does somebody access this particular service? I mean, and is it something for which you have to qualify in some way?
No, I mean, everyone is pretty much eligible for our Meals on Wheels program. There are some assistant programs, T3 government programs that will help you through that. It's just a matter of giving us a call at our location. During it, we do an in-house assessment. Just to identify your needs, we have medical tailored meals is something I want to share too, Dave. Many people don't know about that. And so those people who have, medical elements, diabetes, et cetera, we have meals that are tailored to those individuals. Wow. We are really excited about the direction that we're going. We're going to be very and heavily dependent on as we move forward, which is why Judy explained to you we're looking for that golden unicorn who wants to do this type of work. This is servant work. Yeah. You have to have the heart to do it.
Yeah, Judy, could you just say a word about the kind of work that is involved in the volunteers who specifically are part of Meals on Wheels? What is it that they are called to do, and what are some of the most important aspects of this particular volunteer work?
Sure. I think Ron alluded to it earlier that it's more than just a meal. So it's a wellness check. I can share that my young adult daughter is a volunteer with a little urging from mom. She's been doing it for almost a year, and I think the awakening that she had of people depend on seeing her when she comes. She, has developed a relationship with those people when they come. They write her notes sometimes. And as a young adult, who sometimes they're oblivious, right, to what's going on. So when we talk about our volunteer base, a lot of folks are in our volunteers are retired folks. They've decided that that's how they want to spend, time after they've left their job. But we also have a really great relationship with our colleges and some of our young people. We're really trying to broaden the type of volunteers and that we have, and I think it's kind of exciting. The people love seeing a young person coming with their energy and perhaps their nose piercing and a tattoo or but coming to their door and talking about that. So we really are expanding the work of our volunteers, and everywhere we go, whether it's an event or sometimes we're at expos, we are always looking for volunteers. A lot of people don't know that we're always looking for volunteers, but we continue to expand our base and spread the word about our programs and about our need for volunteers, both.
Yeah, we put a strong emphasis on diversifying our volunteer base, and we've been successful doing so. Even when you talk about ethnicity background, we have more black and brown volunteers than we've ever had before at CAFASI. And to Judy's point, we're working with colleges. We're working with we have an Adopt-A-Route program that works directly with organizations and agencies in the community who incentivize their employees to go out lunchtime for 35 to 45 minutes to deliver a meal. And so that is how we have and sustain the largest volunteer base in southeastern Wisconsin.
That's great. And, of course, you have other programs beyond Meals on Wheels, and I should think all of those, to some extent, are volunteer-driven as well?
All of our programs are volunteer-driven. We have a volunteer transportation program, which is a lot cheaper than Uber and Lyft, people. So if you want to ride, it's 98% cheaper than Uber and Lyft. Please give us a call. We have my favorite program, and I shouldn't be biased as the executive director, but I am for a moment because it hits home for me, is the Music in Memory program. It addresses early dementia and Alzheimer's through the sound of music for 5 to 7 minutes. The sound of music brings back life. that you've never been, that you've never seen before. And having, you know, a father figure, an uncle who passed away from this disease, to hear the testimonies come from that program where you're listening to, you know, Elvis Presley, or you're listening to a James Brown, and, you know, those dance moves come back.
Brings back a memory.
Brings back a memory is so powerful.
Right. Yeah, that seems to be very, very true, that even when a whole lot of other memories are fading, maybe even disappearing altogether, there's something almost magical about the way in which music can have sort
of stimulates the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important. So how many volunteers are we talking about altogether that CAFASI has at the moment?
Yeah, well, at last count, David, it continues to grow, which is a great thing. So keep volunteering, people. Yeah. We need you. We have over 425 volunteers right now. We are pre-COVID numbers now.
Yeah.
Wow.
We've exceeded our numbers now.
Lost a lot of volunteers, obviously, when the COVID pandemic took place. Now we have exceeded those numbers. So this is the largest volunteer base we've ever had at CAFASI.
Fantastic. Are we talking about waiting lists for your services, or at the moment are you pretty much able to service the people who are seeking what you have to offer?
Yeah, we're pretty much able to service the people what we're seeking to have to offer. You know, with the Meals on Wheels program that I alluded to before, there are concerns of a waiting list, which is why we need the community support. Talk to your dignitaries, talk to your friends in Congress to support our Meals on Wheels program in this hashtag Save the Lunch campaign. We want to try to avoid a waiting list as much as we can as possible, but it's all contingent, obviously, on funding.
Right. And, of course, the needs are only going to go up as this segment of the population continues to enlarge. Mm-hmm. So you are sharing a really important message today. Well, before we let you go, we want to circle back to tomorrow's big event and what's going to be going on out at the Parkway Chateau. Remind our listeners about Bowls and Bakers.
Well, it's a great opportunity to come out and enjoy over 9 different soups. You're going to love all of them. Opportunities to raffle, to win a gift basket. We have tremendous gift baskets for everything from gift cards to holiday baskets, lots of services around Kenosha County. So whatever basket you win, you're going to definitely get a value for the money you invested in your ticket. Great bakery items, and of course, a chance to win two tickets to the Packers and Bears game at Soldier Field on Sunday.
There you go. So can people just show up and buy a ticket at the door? They need to buy this ahead of time?
They can. We've sold about 160 tickets online, et cetera. But we will see a lot of people coming in the door tomorrow. So that's kind of where we get to that 300 mark. So we are ready. We are ready to have a lot of fun and see a lot of our old friends that make this an annual event.
Fantastic. So Bowls and Bakers, a huge fundraiser for CAFASI, Kenosha Area Family Services and Aging. We hope that many people will take the opportunity to come out and support this very worthwhile organization and agency. Ron Tatum is its executive director, Judy Abate, director of human relations. We appreciate both of you joining us today on the morning show. We hope that you'll have a very, very successful Bowls and Bakers event tomorrow. And best wishes to you and your staff and your not-so-small army of volunteers for all of the good work that you do in the community. And thanks for being on the morning show today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're glad to be here. Mm-hmm.
The time is 8:38. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. And here's part two of today's program. We spend the next few minutes speaking with Dr. Howard Cutler, a psychiatrist and best-selling author who is responsible or shares responsibility for a very important book which has just been released in a special 10th anniversary edition. The book is called The Art of Happiness, A Handbook for Living. It is co-created by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and Dr. Howard Cutler. And the purpose behind it, which we'll find out a bit more from Dr. Cutler, was, first of all, in a sense, to give more of a human presence, a fully human presence to the Dalai Lama, someone who most of us actually know very, very little about and tend to think of in only rather nebulous and sort of visionary terms. But beyond that, then presenting to the public some thoughts on the matter of happiness, and in a way that could perhaps combine ideas from both East and West, creating a bit of dialogue between, for instance, traditional Buddhist wisdom and Western science. What would that conversation sound like? How would these two very different languages interact? That is what we discover, actually, in the pages of this most intriguing book. Again, the classic book, The Art of Happiness, A Handbook for Living. It's published by Riverhead, which is a division of Penguin Group. And we have Howard Cutler on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about his encounter with the Dalai Lama and the creation of this book. Dr. Howard Cutler, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Good to have you here. Appreciate this opportunity very much. At the front of the book, you talk about your initial encounters with the Dalai Lama and the ultimate creation of this book. Talk a bit further about how little most people really even know about this man and what you were hoping to accomplish in meeting him and perhaps creating something with him.
Well, in terms of how much people know about him, of course, that's changed a lot from the time that I was first working on The Art of Happiness to now. At the time that I first started collaborating on the book with him, of course, his name was known, you know, but very little known about him as a human being, very little known about his particular values. Of course, obviously, in America, the majority of Americans don't know much about Buddhism, which he's a Buddhist monk, but even aside from that, probably when I mentioned the Dalai Lama's name in those days, the most common response if people had heard of him would be a comment about the golf groundskeeper in Caddyshack, Carl, who told a story about caddying for the Dalai Lama. And that was most people's image, or the immediate image that would come up when you mentioned the Dalai Lama's name. But, of course, in 1989, he won the Nobel Peace Prize, and gradually people became a little bit more familiar with him. But still, the principles that he lives by were largely a mystery to the American public, at least. And I felt that having known him for about 10 years when I first started working on The Art of Happiness with him, I first met him in 82 in India, and I found him to be just an amazing man, brilliant mind, great sense of humor, very kind heart, down to earth, very humble, and these wonderful qualities, of course, most people were not familiar with. But I thought that he had a lot to share a general audience, non-Buddhists, on how to become happy, because certainly he is a person, one of those people who has kind of mastered that skill. So that was the idea for The Art of Happiness, was to distill the principles that he lived by that had enabled him to be happy, and present it in a way, as you were kind of saying earlier, that was applicable to a Western audience. So I would frame it from my perspective as a psychiatrist in the context of Western science and psychology, looking for evidence that may support his views, although I was open to finding evidence that would refute his views too, but I didn't find any and still haven't.
It's interesting, you paint kind of a comical picture of when you approached him with this idea of fully expecting him to be resistant to the idea. And you sort of describe a scenario in which you're sort of pressing on with your earnest sales pitch and then just sort of gradually realizing he's already agreeing to this. Straight out of a sitcom script.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. You know, I'd known that people would approach him with projects from time to time, and I'd sort of observed how he would skillfully sort of deflect projects like that by saying, oh, well, you know, I'm not really qualified for that. You know, this other Lama over here or that one over there would be better qualified to work on a book with you. So I was all ready to, you know, argue the case and convince him to work on this project, because I really did believe that it had a lot of value in terms of helping people find an approach to happiness. And in fact, as you were saying, I was so intent on arguing the case. When I first proposed the idea to him, he agreed immediately, but I launched into, you know, I was all ready to argue the case, and it took a second, and he said, well, Howard, I already agreed. Why are you arguing the case?
So, So you end up having, over the course of years, actually, more years than you probably anticipated, having extensive conversations with the Dalai Lama on this topic of how one achieves true happiness. You tell us that those encounters with him, especially right off the bat, were full of surprises and that in no way did they go according to script or agenda.
Yeah, I mean, that's how things turned out. Of course, having this opportunity to work on a book with him, I didn't want to waste a minute of it, so I prepared extensively for our meetings. I had a thick notebook full of questions I wanted to ask him and various things, and I would sort of launch in on my agenda, and quite often he wouldn't respond in the way I had anticipated, or he'd go off on a completely different tangent that I hadn't prepared for. So, you know, the conversations didn't go according to plan, but it turned out good because, you know, I went with the flow, which is all I could do, and probably ended up with a lot more valuable information, as it turned out.
One of the things you say is that when it comes to this kind of dialogue between Buddhism and science, that in fact that isn't quite as deep a chasm or two poles apart arenas like it might be, for instance, with other sorts of religions or faiths. In what way do you see Buddhism and the world of science more compatible than we might immediately think?
Well, several ways. One way is that Buddhism isn't kind of a faith-based religion as we normally think of religion. It was founded by the Buddha 2,500 years ago, who is not considered God or anything like that. Buddha was an ordinary man who developed his mind and achieved an inner kind of transformation. And then he set about, after he achieved that, to teach other people that. But the Buddha's approach was a very empiric approach. So from the beginning of Buddhism, he would told his students, look, this is what I found, but don't just take my word for it just because I say so. You know, try out these techniques for yourself. He used the analogy of just like a goldsmith would test out gold to see if it's genuine. In the same way, use your own reason, use your own common sense, practice these techniques and see if it happens to be true for you. So that's the same spirit, that spirit of inquiry, of discovery, of practical experience that is part of Buddhism. And of course, the Dalai Lama has that same spirit. I've heard him lots of times in his talks at the end. He'll say, well, you know, if something I've said, you know, this afternoon you find useful, then great, use it. And if something I've said, you know, you don't find useful, just forget about it. You know, that kind of spirit. So, of course, Western science also is based on, you know, empiric evidence and so on. So really, they're very congruent in that sense. And the Dalai Lama personally, of course, is very interested in science and, you know, taking a look at scientific research on some of these Buddhist techniques and so on.
What you ultimately found as we kind of total all this up is an intriguing mix of optimism and realism in the way that the Dalai Lama approaches this matter of achieving happiness. Talk a moment about that.
Actually, that's a good way of putting it. It is a great balance of optimism, but realism. One of the Dalai Lama's favorite phrases is realistic, which, you know, he's joked about in the past in some of our conversations because he said, you know, some of the people get sick of me saying realistic, realistic. But when he talks about realistic, you know, he'll use phrases like realistic outlook or realistic attitudes and so on. He's not talking about realistic in the sense of, oh, you know, somebody might say, be realistic, like be practical or, you know, that type of thing. He's talking about realistic in the sense of corresponding to reality, which, of course, is a big thing in Buddhism. One of the underlying principles of Buddhism is to discover the underlying nature of reality, because ignorance of the nature of reality, delusion, and seeing things in a way that doesn't correspond to how they really exist is sort of part of Buddhist philosophy.
Hmm.
So, for example, where the optimism comes in is that, you know, part of seeing things realistically or seeing things in reality is, let's say you have a problem that you're overwhelmed with. You're worried about it. You're focused on it. Or it could be you're angry about something, and you think about the person you're angry with, and you know you're just seething. Well, when the human being has those type of intense emotions, which we usually call negative emotions or destructive emotions, I'm talking about anger, fear, anxiety, hatred, jealousy, and so on. What happens is our perception narrows. You know, we see things in terms of all good, all bad, all black, all white. You know, we lose the sense of the gray areas. We lose the sense of reality. So the practice to deal with those type of situations that are causing a person unhappiness, of course, because those kind of emotions are disturbing and so on, is to see things from a wider perspective, to realize that, yes, there are negative aspects to this situation, but to make a concerted effort to also look for the potential positive aspects, potential benefits of this situation, potential positive outcomes or opportunities that may be inherent. Even if it's a purely bad situation and the only positive thing is that, okay, I've gone through a difficult time, it'll make me stronger, or maybe I can learn something from it or whatever. And usually there's a few more benefits than that if you investigate. But that engenders a sense of optimism, just having that realistic outlook that's more balanced, that sees things from that wider perspective, is associated with positive emotions. And in fact, we could get into the evolutionary reasons why our perception narrows when we have negative emotions and the association between positive emotions and that broader perspective, which is interesting. But, you know, just sort of as an overview, that's kind of the link between optimism and realism in the sense that the Dalai Lama uses the word.
Hmm. The book goes on to explore other ways in which happiness is fostered and achieved and retained and shared with others. The book explores how, in a sense, we are created to seek happiness. There's no higher purpose. But that it goes on to talk of the importance of compassion in how we live and how really this is where the deepest sort of happiness and fulfillment is stoked. And the book also does not shy away from the harsh reality that is part of so many lives in the section called Transforming Suffering. And of course, the Dalai Lama is well acquainted with just how painful human suffering can be.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as far as the compassion you were mentioning, that's as far as the art of happiness approach to achieving happiness, which, as you mentioned earlier, is kind of a blend of the East and West. The idea of kindness, compassion, caring for other people is integral to that approach to happiness. In fact, from our perspective, there's an inextricable link between personal happiness and kindness, compassion, caring towards others. Not only does research show that happy individuals tend to be kinder, more charitable, more willing to reach out and help other people, but the opposite as well is a principle that the book talks about, which is that the deliberate cultivation of kindness, compassion, and so on is an effective approach to increasing personal happiness. And in fact, that was one of the reasons for doing this 10th anniversary edition, is that at the time that book was written, of course, one of my hopes was to provide scientific evidence in support or of the Dalai Lama's ideas. And there was some research done at that time, but not too much. For example, there was research showing that, you know, some people think the pursuit of happiness is self-centered and selfish. When you say the purpose of life is happiness, oh, that's so self-indulgent and self-focused and so on. But actually, the opposite is the case, that it's unhappy people who are more self-focused and selfish and hostile, and happy people are generally kinder, more altruistic, and so on. So there was evidence of that at that time, but the opposite thing, the deliberate cultivation of compassion, as a technique to become happier, which is really hard for people in the West, that idea, and it was for me too. I'll tell you a story later on about that, but there wasn't evidence. But since then, within months of the publication of The Art of Happiness, just coincidentally, there was formally established entirely new branch of psychology called positive psychology, which is essentially the science of human happiness. And what happened was, at the time, The Art of Happiness, that I was writing it and that it was published, happiness wasn't a very popular topic. It took me years even to get a publisher. I just got rejection after rejection after rejection for years for that book. But it came out in 98, and 98 and 99, there was just this explosion of interest in the subject among both the scientific community and the general public. In fact, for the first time in human history, happiness had finally become a legitimate subject for scientific inquiry. So since then, there were some great experiments showing that compassion leads to happiness. In fact, Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin did some studies where he brought Tibetan Buddhist monks into the lab and, you know, hooked them up to his EEG machines and these wonderful brain scans that can show brain activity in, you know, real time, and asked a monk to meditate on compassion. And what happened was, previously he had identified an area of the brain associated with happiness in the left prefrontal cortex, and he found that generating a compassionate state of mind, meditating on compassion and so on, just lit up that happiness area of the brain, which to me is just a wonderful sort of demonstration of that link between compassion and happiness.
Hmm. We learn about that and much more in the pages of this very thought-provoking book, again called The Art of Happiness, A Handbook for Living. Surely many of you have heard of it, now out in a beautifully crafted 10th anniversary edition. And the man responsible for it, Dr. Howard Cutler. Again, the book is published by Riverhead, which is a division of Penguin. Dr. Cutler, I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. I thank you so much.
Greg, can I mention
yes.
That also in conjunction with this 10th anniversary edition, the third volume of the Art of Happiness series has come out, called The Art of Happiness in a Troubled World. And if anybody is interested in more information, they can always go to the website, theartofhappiness.com. So I would throw that into the mix.
Very good. Thank you again for your time.
Thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Simon Parkin, the author of a fascinating book called The Forbidden Garden, The Botanists of Besieged Leningrad and Their Impossible Choice. The book tells the amazing story and true story of something called the Plant Institute, which was in Leningrad, the world's first significant seed depository. And it was thought to be a means to stave off the catastrophe of future famines. And during the siege of Leningrad by Nazi Germany, the staff of the Plant Institute was charged with guarding the contents of that depository from that potential invasion. It's an amazing story. We'll follow it up with a local guest, Curzio Caravatti, who is actually a participant in a similar sort of archive, one devoted to the preservation of many, many, many varieties of potatoes. Thursday, by the way, will be the monthly visit of Kaylin Palomares, and she'll have with her Marty Johnson from the Wisconsin DNR. And sports writer John Feinstein will be my guest on Friday. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today, partly cloudy skies, a high of 49 degrees, overnight low of 41 degrees. A chance of rain tomorrow with a high of 53. Rain is very likely, actually, Wednesday night and all day on Thursday. Daytime highs will remain in the low 50s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.